First, all participants are in a listen-only mode, and as a reminder, this program will be recorded today. This session is presented by the National Brain Tumor Society, and this is Rebecca Jones, Program Manager in Patient Services at the National Brain Tumor Society. I'm also joined by Tamar Sakayan, Interim Director in Patient Services, and Jill DeBartok, Program Manager in Patient Services. And we're so happy that many of you have been able to join us today. We have people from all over the country joining us, in addition to international participants today from England, Canada, and Australia. So welcome, everyone. The National Brain Tumor Society is a leader in the brain tumor community, bringing together the best of research, patient services, and public policy to be a comprehensive resource for patients, families, caregivers, researchers, and medical professionals. We have a national presence with offices on both coasts and activities and influence around the United States. And before we get started, I did want to let all of you know a little bit about some of the services that are available to you through the National Brain Tumor Society. First of all, our patient services team, including our medical information specialists, can be reached at 800-934-2873 or by email at info@braintumor.org. You can also visit our comprehensive website at www.braintumor.org. Some of the programs and services that we offer include a clinical trials matching service, patient and caregiver support network, resource directory, treatment center database, interactive online community, several free publications, including our Essential Guide to Brain Tumors, and much more. And again, you can visit our website at www.braintumor.org. And today I'd like to welcome back our special guest speaker, Dr. Mark Gilbert. Dr. Gilbert is a neuro-oncologist at MD Anderson Cancer Center in Texas and a principal investigator at the Collaborative Ependymoma Research Network, also known as the CERN Foundation. And hopefully some of you were able to watch our recorded webinar that was available on our website, where Dr. Gilbert answered common questions about ependymoma tumors. Today, Dr. Gilbert will respond to some of your additional questions about ependymomas. And just so you all know, we continue to receive lots of questions, so it's really great. We've received so many questions, especially even last night. So we'll try our best to answer as many as we can. We are limited to an hour-long session today. So we will be responding to questions that were both submitted ahead of time and those that are chatted in today, and we'll do our best. So, Dr. Gilbert, the first question was that there are several different ependymoma subtypes. Where and what tests are done to determine the ependymoma type?
So, let me, again, thank everybody for joining us. The ependymoma subtypes are really some very cutting-edge research done by my colleague Richard Gilbertson at the St. Jude's Children's Cancer Research Institute in Memphis. They looked at a series of ependymomas from both adults and pediatrics and found that based on their molecular profile by the genes expressed, that there appeared to be 9 distinct subcategories. We are now in the process of validating those findings and trying to look at the individual subtypes to see if we can find specific therapies that would target that molecular subtype. This is ongoing work. This work was actually recently published in a very prestigious scientific journal called Nature, and that happened about 6 months ago. So this is really very cutting-edge stuff and something that the CERN is focused a lot of effort in, and we're now collecting tumor tissues and clinical information on a large series of patients to validate this.
Thank you. And the next question comes from one of our participants that's a long-term survivor with brain and spinal cord involvement. And we've actually had several questions related to rehabilitation. This participant experiences regular falling, poor coordination, difficulty walking, and no control of bowel or bladder function. So I was wondering if you could speak on some general tips for rehabilitation, especially for some of our long-term survivors and those that have gone through, you know, multiple series of radiation, and just sort of touch on that because we did have a few questions related to that today.
So the issue of rehabilitation is obviously critically important, and some recent information suggests that people with ependymomas can do extremely well from a tumor standpoint, but often have difficulties related to the tumor, the surgical treatment, or in fact the radiation, the therapy. So it is really the long-term effects of having had the tumor or its treatment that can really compromise quality of life. So there is great interest in looking at rehabilitation types of strategies, particularly for spinal cord. And in this regard, I think there have been some advances in the rehabilitation field. Unfortunately, to date, there's nothing that actually regenerates nervous system tissue. But I would encourage people, particularly with spinal cord injury, to look at other support. There are spinal cord injury groups, and the issues that they deal with would be quite similar. And I'd also very strongly encourage people to be evaluated by a physician who specializes in rehabilitation. They're called physical medicine and rehabilitation, PM&R specialists, and they would have the cutting-edge information regarding exercise programs and additional efforts that really help people maximize their function, even if there is underlying brain or spinal cord injury.
Great, thank you. And the next questions are about radiation therapy. The first question that we have also applies to the ependymoma recorded webinar. And again, for those of you who have not listened to that recorded webinar, it's a great foundational webinar on ependymoma tumors. So it is still available on our website, and it will be uploaded there for quite some time. So if you don't, you can't listen to it today, then just revisit it anytime. But the question is, Dr. Gilbert mentioned that radiation therapy has a potential for long-term injury that is time-related. Can he explain further what was meant by time-related?
Sure, that's a great question. So radiation does affect brain and spinal cord tissue, and there is a definite relationship between the dose administered and the risk of developing that injury. It is, in fact, a late complication of therapy. We typically see radiation-induced injury to nervous system tissue earliest about 18 months, and typically it peaks at about 3 or 4 years, but there certainly have been reports of people many years later developing a radiation injury. It is not uniform, and there seems to be variability and susceptibility from person to person. For radiation to the brain, the risk of developing significant brain injury is estimated to be around 5%. So the majority of people do demonstrate on imaging studies some changes related to their radiation treatment, but a very small percentage really develop a lot of significant problem. But it is time-related. It is not something we typically see early on, but it is seen months to sometimes years after the initial radiation treatment.
Great, thank you. We did also get several questions about prevention and tumor recurrence. One participant asked for adults who have been treated with ependymomas but have no evidence of disease at this time, what would you recommend for reducing the risk of recurrence and such things as diet, exercise, or vitamins?
So, a great question, and I wish I had a great answer. We right now do not have any therapies that have been proven to have any impact on preventing essentially any cancer from coming back, and certainly that's the case for ependymoma. Good diet, exercise, and modest vitamins are all good ideas. It will probably not prevent the tumor from coming back if it's destined to do so, but what it does do is it puts you in the best shape to handle any additional treatment. And there is a very strong relationship between success of therapy and the person's ability to handle the treatment. So if the doctors are able to give you the full treatment with a minimal amount of side effects because you're in good physical shape and good nutritional status, then you're making it that much easier to take care of the tumor if it does come back. But as far as something that's preventative, unfortunately, We don't have anything for that.
We just received a question online. The question is, are there any novel treatments for children who have had recurrence? In this particular case, radiation is no longer an option.
So that's a great question. There are no standards of care for either adult or pediatric patients who have had radiation therapy and now ependymoma has grown back. So that has led us to have a great interest in both age groups in looking at clinical trials. And I know that in the pediatric community, and I am not a pediatric oncologist, but I certainly interact through the CERN with some of the top pediatric oncologists in the country, that there are several clinical trials. The CERN has a clinical trial looking at this exact situation. These clinical trials typically involve chemotherapy regimens. There are some chemotherapies that are used in pediatric ependymoma, but none have had the type of success that would make them a standard of care, which is why there's active clinical trials looking for therapies that would reliably result in a tumor response. Some physicians do recommend in certain circumstances a repeat operation to remove tumor, and sometimes consider using radiation therapy again, particularly if it appeared to be quite successful in its...
The next question we have is related to prognosis. The question is there much difference on average survival for a cranial anaplastic ependymoma in an adult as compared to lower grade ependymomas?
So the prognosis and difference between anaplastic ependymoma and a low grade ependymoma is there. The extent of which that impacts prognosis is still being defined. The criteria that are used by our pathologists to distinguish an anaplastic from a low-grade ependymoma are not as clearly defined as it is for other types of brain and spinal cord tumors. So because of that, there is not as strong a correlation with outcome. When you have an anaplastic ependymoma, it does change treatment approach. Sometimes in adults, if there's been complete removal of a low-grade ependymoma, we would observe, but with an anaplastic ependymoma, since the likelihood it would grow back without additional treatment is so high, we would always consider radiation therapy. The likelihood of anaplastic ependymoma coming back is higher than low-grade ependymoma, and they can be less responsive to treatment because they are higher grade and a more malignant tumor.
Thank you. We also had another question related to tumor recurrence and stereotactic radiosurgery options. One of the questions is, can CyberKnife treat both brain and spinal cord tumors? And what is the best course of radiation treatment for recurrent ependymoma tumors in the brain versus the spinal cord?
So this is a very interesting question. And the use of CyberKnife, for those who don't know, this is focused radiation. The advantage of a technique like CyberKnife or Gamma Knife or other types of what we call stereotactic radiosurgery is that you can really pinpoint the radiation beam so that there's very little exposure to surrounding normal tissues. That's an advantage in preventing harm to surrounding tissues. But it's a disadvantage if there are tumor cells that have spread from the main tumor mass into the surrounding brain tissue. So that always remains the big question. Ependymomas tend not to spread as much into surrounding spinal cord or brain tissues as other types of brain tumors, but they still can. And they're more likely to spread if they are anaplastic as opposed to the low-grade ependymoma. So I think radiosurgery, whether it's CyberKnife or Gamma Knife or LINAC, they're all reasonable treatments for recurrent ependymoma, particularly when you're concerned about increasing the exposure of the surrounding nervous tissue, whether spinal cord or brain, to additional radiation if the patient or person has already had radiation treatment. So it remains a treatment option. Again, it is limited. It's limited really to tumors of a certain size, typically 3 to 3.5 centimeters in diameter is the largest. And I think the benefit of it diminishes if there are several spots that need to be treated. So, you know, I think each individual person should be evaluated based on location of their tumor, what their prior therapy has been, and what the potential risks are of going forward with this type of treatment.
We had several questions about ependymoma tumor type and survival statistics. I was wondering if you could just touch on what those survival statistics are a bit based on the tumor type, just because there's quite a variety of questions that we received on that topic.
So the outcome statistics vary on the basis of several factors. The first is age. The second is a tumor location. And the third is tumor grade. In most circumstances, looking at a worse prognosis than the grade 2 or low-grade ependymoma, there are, in fact, grade 1 ependymoma, which are considered benign. And these are tumors like the myxopapillary ependymoma of the spinal cord. These tumors, if completely removed surgically, are very frequently cured. But focusing now on the grade 2 and grade 3 ependymoma setup, we would classify that as either ependymoma or, for grade 3, the anaplastic ependymoma. There is differences based on age. So from recent work looking at large national databases, children under the age of 2 and adults over the age of 60, 65 tend to have the worst outcome, and people in between tend to have the best prognosis. But again, part of that is dependent upon location, and part of that's dependent upon tumor grade. So, as I said before, grade 3 tumors don't do as well as overall as patients who have grade 2 tumors, and patients who have tumors in their spinal cord, and that's predominantly adults, do better than patients who have tumors in their brain. So there are a variety of factors. One of the most important factors that is unrelated to the tumor itself, the patient's age, is how successful the surgeon is. So there's also a very important factor if the surgeon's able to remove the tumor entirely. Those folks tend to do better than situations where the tumor can only be biopsied or only part of it removed.
Okay, thank you so much. And this is also a bit on the same line. We do have parents listening in today whose children are ependymoma survivors. One of our participants' daughter was diagnosed at age 3 and is now 16 years old. And this question is about recurrence. So the question is, what is the outlook or likelihood that a pediatric anaplastic ependymoma survivor will develop a secondary cancer or recurrence? And what are the statistics?
So the I don't think that there are, I know there are no specific statistics for an ependymoma survivor. I know that there's been a lot of work looking at the risk of secondary cancers in children treated at, obviously in the pediatric group, and then when they're adults, what's their risk? So the risk of developing a second cancer is higher in children who have been treated for cancer when they're adults than it is for the general population, but it is not tremendously higher. So the percentage does increase. There is a risk, depending upon what the primary treatment was, of developing some fairly uncommon cancers, such as leukemia. So overall, there is a modest increase in risk, but many, many children who are cured of their childhood cancer do not develop cancer as adults.
Thank you. The next question that we received was just chatted online. The question is, what is the status of the CERN study of the lapatinib and Avastin?
So lapatinib and Avastin, or bevacizumab, is a currently ongoing clinical trial in CERN. We are actively enrolling patients on this study and have not yet reached a point where we have done an analysis. It is designed to be in two steps, so we're going to enroll, I think, approximately 20 children onto the study and to see how they do. And if we see a certain level of effectiveness, then we're going to go on and treat an additional 20 children. So we're in the throes of doing that. We did realize early on that the dose of the lapatinib was too high. We had based it on some previous work, but not in combination with Avastin. So we have recently put through an amendment to the protocol and have slightly reduced the dose of the lapatinib. But it is ongoing at the CERN pediatric sites. And if somebody's interested in considering this clinical trial, then I would recommend going to the CERN website, which is cern-foundation.org, and looking up one of those sites, or just making an inquiry through the CERN, and they can help connect you with one of the CERN pediatric centers.
Great, thank you. So on that line, is that the best way for individuals to get in touch with clinical trials at CERN?
Yes.
Through the website?
Through the website, it's very easy. You just say, contact CERN, and typically people get a response within 24 hours. And we help facilitate a connection with one of the CERN sites, and we are geographically distributed across the United States, and now have a pediatric site in Canada, and hopefully in the near future we'll actually even have sites over in Europe. So we're trying to address the needs gradually growing, but it's very easy to make a connection and to get a direct referral to one of the CERN investigators who have special interest and knowledge in treating ependymoma.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you. So now I have another question that just came in, and this was an earlier question that was pre-submitted. What about vaccine trials? So can you talk a little bit about vaccine trials in ependymoma?
To my knowledge, there are no vaccine trials ongoing in ependymoma. One of the key features of a vaccine therapy is to have some unique aspect of the tumor that would allow the immune system to distinguish it from the rest of the normal cells in the body, so that the immune system would obviously selectively target the tumor. There is work going on in other types of brain tumors, and to my knowledge, there is no active work right now going on looking at that type of strategy for ependymoma. I'm hoping that with the ongoing laboratory work, our colleagues will uncover some targetable differences that would make an ependymoma cancer cell unique, and we could consider in the future some type of vaccine or immunology strategy.
So we also received several questions about possible causes or genetic links with ependymomas. One question is, has a connection been made to herpes simplex virus and adult onset ependymomas?
So there's been no, to my knowledge, no causal event for ependymoma. So that we do not know of a viral cause. Certainly, herpes simplex is very prevalent. People have been exposed to it, and again, the incidence of ependymoma is quite low. Molecular studies have not shown any viral components to ependymoma, nor have studies by electron microscopy. So I'd have to say at this point, we don't see any connection between any viral infection and development of ependymoma.
Okay. And another question is, can ependymomas run in families? And also, is it possible that some sort of gene therapy protocol could be developed?
So the answer to the first one, it is not one of the well-known genetic syndromes. Theoretically, if we knew more about the genetics, there could be some underlying familial process, but we do not routinely see ependymomas run in families. So I would have to say the answer to that is predominantly no. The second question is a great question about gene therapies, and clearly what we would like to be is in a position to find a gene that, if we were able to manipulate that gene in the ependymoma, in the cancer cells, that either we turn on or turn off and then prevent the ependymoma from either growing or hopefully even have the tumor die, that would be wonderful. In order to accomplish that, we're going to need to do two things. One is to find the gene that is so critical to the function of the cancer cell. And once we do that, then develop a way of delivering the gene to all of the tumor cells. I think that this is possible, but will require a tremendous amount of research before we can actually get that to a point where it's ready for clinical trial. But
okay.
Certainly in the laboratory, we can manipulate tumor cells and turn them on and turn them off.
Great. Thank you. We also have just a couple of other questions related to possible causes of ependymoma or links. Another one is, has there been any research done on the correlation of spinal ependymomas and autism?
To my knowledge, there has not been any research looking at that link. So I would have to say I'm not aware of anything in that regard.
Okay, and the last question related to this same strain of questions is, do you know if exposure to Agent Orange is a factor in developing an anaplastic ependymoma?
So Agent Orange connection with cancer has obviously been very, very carefully studied. There has not, to my knowledge, in all of the population studies of ependymoma, has there been a causal link. But I am not certain if we have a good handle on the number of people who have had ependymoma who were also exposed to Agent Orange. So it would be a very difficult connection to make, particularly since the number of adults with ependymoma each year is quite small. So it would be very hard from a study perspective unless there seemed to be a very large group of people with ependymoma who were also exposed to Agent Orange, and I'm not sure that data has been collected.
Okay, thank you. I did want to touch on the topic of misdiagnoses. I know you highlighted that in the recorded webinar, but we had several questions about that. I'm going to give one of the examples today that came in. So one of our participants today has a daughter that was diagnosed and treated for a low-grade astrocytoma in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. And then in 2009, her daughter had a third recurrence in the same area of her brain. And leading pathologists have disagreed on what the tumor type is at this point. She was told it's either a grade 3 glioma, and then another pathologist has said it was an ependymoma. So her question is, can a tumor change from a low-grade astrocytoma to an ependymoma, or is it possible that a different tumor type occurred altogether, and how common is this?
So it's not possible, in my understanding, that a glioma became an ependymoma. It is possible that the initial diagnosis, it was very difficult to really figure out what type of brain tumor it was. Clearly, the most common would be a glioma. I don't know if anybody's gone back to look at that in retrospect. It is potentially possible to develop a second type of tumor in the same area because that area has received treatment, and we do see second cancers developing in areas of therapy, particularly radiation treatment. And I think what's really important to know is that sometimes the diagnosis of ependymoma is not straightforward. And in many instances, it's really not a question of misdiagnosis, but more a question of different interpretation. So you can get some of the top neuropathologists in the world looking at the same tumor material and come up with a different diagnosis. And so I think in that circumstance, they're neither right nor wrong. They just have a difference of opinion. That will change, hopefully, in the near future when we find that we can use molecular diagnostic techniques, looking for specific genes that are characteristic of ependymoma versus other types of tumor, and then you could be more certain of the diagnosis. So I think when we look at literature, we have pathologists who are have specialized in ependymoma, who have interest and expertise, we often use them as the gold standard. But all that says is that we've decided to use them as the reference and say whatever they have agreed on would be ependymoma. But we may find out, in fact, that some of the other tumors that they called not ependymoma are actually ependymoma. They just don't have all the characteristic appearances of ependymoma. So the diagnosis in many cases is very straightforward, but in some it can be quite difficult, and you can get a whole series of opinions and they all be different.
All right, thank you. On that note, can you just touch on what a center of excellence is for ependymoma and how patients can access a center of excellence?
So a center of excellence is a very difficult thing to define. I would define a center of excellence as a medical facility that has expressed interest in and is actively pursuing either clinical or laboratory research or both in the area of ependymoma, to have healthcare providers there who have that distinct interest and have a sense of what the disease is about, have experience with the disease. So it allows them to focus, and they hopefully have enough clinical experience that they can really render expert opinion as far as treatments and provide care that is specific or addresses the specific needs of patients with ependymoma. In the CERN, we have recruited several centers in both adults and pediatrics around the U.S., as I mentioned before, and now Canada. And each of these centers have healthcare providers who really have a specific interest in ependymoma, and so they will provide expert advice, consultation, and, if necessary, treatment. But there are additional centers around the United States that have people with similar skills and knowledge. So the definition there is not a set of criteria that we can use. It's just really more of a sense of interest and willingness to provide outstanding care for patients with ependymoma.
Great, thank you. So we have several chat questions coming in, so thank you for all submitting those right now. One of the questions is, please discuss chemo for a recurring adult tumor. In this particular case, the patient has had radiation and surgery.
So there are no established chemotherapy regimens for adult ependymoma. And what I mean by that is there are several chemotherapy treatments that are used, but nothing has been determined to be the absolute standard of care. And one of our goals in CERN is to make a concerted effort to actually do very rigorous clinical trials to hopefully establish treatments that we can say are beneficial therapies for patients, particularly in this case adults, with ependymoma that has grown after initial surgery and radiation therapy. In fact, the major focus of CERN is to develop new treatments for both adults and pediatrics. And so we have an ongoing clinical trial and have a pipeline where we have three additional clinical studies that are in the process of being developed and launched so that there are several options for patients with recurring ependymoma.
Thank you. And just to let everybody know, we do have 10 minutes remaining for the webinar. However, if it's okay, Dr. Gilbert, could we go over maybe 5 minutes today?
Sure. Absolutely.
Okay, because we did get started late and there were some technical problems. So we'll just keep asking the questions that are rolling in. So one of the next questions I got was, apart from an MRI to monitor tumor status, are there other ways to monitor tumor growth?
So the best way is by imaging. So there are no substitutes. Unfortunately, there are no blood tests to tell us early on if there's a tumor coming back. So I would say the optimal way is to be diligent and vigilant in following up with your healthcare team and making sure that the imaging is done on a routine basis, and that we, you know, remain observant. And this way, if tumor does come back, it's caught early, and things can be taken care of before there are any additional problems.
Great. We received another question that's related to this. Apart from MRIs every 3 months to monitor status, would we expect lumbar punctures or similar?
So that's a great question. In the disease medulloblastoma, which is actually the most common pediatric brain tumor, it is quite common for tumor to spread into spinal fluid. It is much less common for it to spread in ependymoma. And so we don't routinely do lumbar punctures. We sometimes do them early on to make sure there is no tumor in the spinal fluid. If a person has a tumor that there's concern because of its location that it may be more likely to have spread into spinal fluid, then that could be considered a part of the evaluation. We often use spine MRI scans as a screening tool to see if we see any evidence that there may be spread into spinal fluid. Sometimes you can see a tumor that has attached to the spinal cord. That would be an indication that there is tumor there. But routinely, we don't often do spinal taps to look for tumor cells.
Okay, thank you. We received a question, any common genetic abnormalities found in pediatric ependymomas?
Well, there's a whole variety of genetic abnormalities. The more we learn, as I mentioned earlier on, we see that there are actually probably some pretty distinct subtypes that differ from one another by their genetic abnormalities, so there's not one overriding genetic abnormality. And that may be why some of our treatments really benefit some folks and don't seem to have much effect on other tumors. So the more we learn about that, we will probably be able to do that type of testing and really personalize or individualize therapy, and that's obviously our great goal over the next several years.
Great. Our next question is there a period of time after gross total resection that you can be confident that the chances of recurrence drop significantly?
Boy, that's a really great question, really hard question, and part of the answer to that relates to the grade of tumor. So with a grade 3 tumor, an anaplastic ependymoma, the growth rate of remaining tumor would be much quicker or faster than with a low-grade tumor. So you would expect if there is going to be tumor regrowth of an anaplastic tumor, you would see it earlier than with a low-grade. Low-grade tumors can be quite slow, and the grade 1 tumors, like the myxopapillary ependymoma, can be extremely slow. And so it may be a couple of years before some remaining tumor cells grow large enough to actually see them. So I think it varies by tumor grade, but I would say that if that it's been more than 5 years and nothing has regrown, the chances are pretty low for any of the types of tumors. But we certainly have seen late regrowth, so I would caution anybody against saying, okay, we're done and we're not going to go back and get follow-up.
Great. Thanks so much for that. And we did get several questions about recurrence throughout the chat boards and previously today. We do have another question here. It's, I am a 30-year-old survivor diagnosed at age 7. Are there others like me?
The answer is absolutely yes. So many.
And I'm sorry. One second, Dr. Gilbert. I meant she. I think she's 40, actually. I believe talking with her, but she says a 30-plus-year-old survivor.
Okay. Yes. Absolutely.
Okay. Sorry about that.
And there is a fairly substantial group of pediatric patients who are actually cured of their ependymoma. And in a recent survey that we did through the CERN, and I would encourage those people who haven't been to the website to look at the Ependymoma Outcomes Project, which you can enroll, we found that over 60% of the folks who responded are out many years without tumor recurrence. And so they are ependymoma patients, but many of them may be ependymoma survivors. So, you know, I think people can do quite well, and we find that very encouraging. And one of our jobs is to have that type of benefit even in people whose tumors come back after their initial treatment.
Great, thank you. Another question we received is, what statistics are there on spinal ependymoma recurrence for adults between the ages of 20 and 30?
So we don't have any specific data on a particular age group. Again, we're talking about a relatively rare disease. I would estimate the number of adults in the United States who develop a spinal cord ependymoma a year is going to be in the range of 120 to 200. So I certainly don't have it by age. What we do know is that it does vary based on grade of tumor. And if an adult with a myxopapillary ependymoma has a complete removal of tumor, there is a high likelihood that that person is cured of the disease. It's much less likely if it's an anaplastic ependymoma, although we have seen people who have had excellent surgical resection of anaplastic ependymoma, then radiation, and then, you know, it has been years and there has been no evidence of tumor regrowth. A lot of our information about long-term survival of ependymoma by definition means that these people were treated years and years ago, and I will state that the prognosis now is going to be better. My neurosurgical colleagues are better and better at getting tumor out. They have better technology. And so the percentage of people with ependymoma who have excellent surgeries is going to continue to increase. The more people that have excellent surgery, the more people who have a better chance of having a very long-term survival. So I think the prognosis is going to continue to improve, and of course I'm quite optimistic that through efforts at CERN and other groups, we're going to come up with better treatments, and it's all going to work together, and the outlook for people with ependymoma is going to continue to look better and better.
Wonderful. Thank you. I think we have time for just a couple more questions. I know we received so many of them, and some of you may need to leave right at 12, so we're just going to ask a couple more today. And then please remind us, send me an email or us an email at info@braintumor.org with any questions that did not get answered today, and we'll try our best to respond to those in our online forums in the upcoming weeks or so. But I'm going to go ahead and ask just a couple more, and thank you, Dr. Gilbert, for taking a little bit of extra time here. So one of the questions is, does radiation exposure of a father cause ependymoma in a child?
There has been no link to parental radiation exposure, particularly in the father, any type of tumor that I'm aware of. Obviously, maternal radiation exposure would be a concern if the mother is carrying the child, but I'm not aware of any paternal to child association.
Okay, thank you. We have an interesting question here. For pediatric anaplastic ependymoma survivors, does puberty play a protective factor against development of secondary cancers? And are there research findings on this?
That is a very interesting question. I don't actually know the answer to that question. I'm not familiar with any research, although I must admit that is not a literature that I routinely follow. So that's something that would warrant some investigation and inquiry of some of my pediatric colleagues who would have a much better idea of the answer to that question. And we'll be happy to answer that and post that.
Okay, great. Thank you. And we have a couple of questions that are related to CERN, so we'll go ahead and end on that. Is CERN receiving enough tumor tissue samples for their studies?
So thank you for that question. And the answer is we are working with collaborators and colleagues across the United States, and we have recently created a collaboration with some outstanding colleagues in Italy and France. And so it looks like we will have a sufficient sample of ependymoma tumors so that we'll be able to do a lot of exciting molecular work so we can hopefully come back in the not-too-distant future in this type of venue and talk about how we've really changed our understanding of ependymoma. But the answer is yes, there's been a tremendous amount of now international enthusiasm for participating by providing the tumor tissues and also the very important clinical information so that we can look to see if there are differences in the way the tumors behave and the outcomes in folks' responses to treatment, because we're getting all the treatment information as it relates to the specific ependymoma subtype.
That's great. Thank you. And then the next question, also related to CERN, is the three trials that are currently in the pipeline, when can we expect that data?
Well, I think the more pertinent question is when can we expect the trials to be open for accrual? So the current ependymoma clinical trial for adults is looking to enroll 50 patients. We now have 20 patients. And so as more people hear about CERN, we're hopeful that they will consider at least discussing clinical trial or investigating clinical trial. Again, the distribution of patients with ependymoma is not in one place, and people are spread around the country. That's why we have chosen excellent clinical centers in brain tumor research around the United States so that it would make it a little bit easier for people to get there to enroll in trials to make it, the most compatible with maintaining other aspects of daily life, but it still is difficult. They are centered mostly in large cities, but it still requires some involvement. So the more folks we can get enrolled in clinical trials, the quicker we will get answers. And we're hoping that discussions like this will at least spark interest in folks looking at our website. And all of my colleagues, of course, including myself, are always happy to provide information and discuss individual situations and to see if involvement in a certain clinical trial is a possibility.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much. And for all of you who have submitted questions, and if they did not get answered today, like I said, even though the program is about to end, we will try and address most of those questions in our online forums over the next weeks, and I'm going to show you where that's at. And I really appreciate all of you who have joined us today. We had such an overwhelming response, and it's just wonderful that we have so many people online and joining us by phone today. So thank you so much. And I do apologize for the technical glitch at the beginning, and it seems like you all stood through, and we got through it. So there is going to be an evaluation survey at the end of this session. So if you are joining us online today, you will be logged out and you'll receive an evaluation. We really take your comments and feedback seriously. We use it to help develop new programs, to develop more information on topics. So please take the time to fill that out. And if you haven't joined us online today, I will be forwarding that survey by email today as well. So it is important that unanswered questions today will be responded to in our ependymoma forum and our online community, and that is at http://my.braintumorcommunity.org. And then, of course, you can always call our patient services team at 800-934-2873. You can also email us at info@braintumor.org. And as a reminder, this program has been recorded. So if you are joining us today, we'll try and get that link out to you so you can listen to the recorded webinar. And again, go ahead and contact us or email us if you have questions, and please do visit our online community for more information in the upcoming weeks. Again, that's my.braintumorcommunity.org. And again, I wanted to thank Dr. Gilbert for that excellent information and for the recorded webinar and just for responding to all those questions today. Great information. So thank you so much.
You're very welcome, and thank you, everybody, and Rebecca, for this excellent forum.
Thank you. Okay, well, this concludes our program. So thanks again, everybody, for joining us today. Goodbye.